ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Hello and welcome to Rear Vision. I'm Ros Bluett. 30 years ago, 123 countries signed an agreement to create the World Trade Organization.
Today's four-hour ceremony in Marrakesh created a muscular international watchdog, the World Trade Organization. This new global treaty aims to prevent the law of the jungle from ruling over world trade. Politicians hope the agreement will prevent the world from sliding into protectionism.
3 decades on, and the slide towards protectionism is gaining speed, and the law of the jungle is encroaching. At this year's G20 summit in Johannesburg, the issue of fair international trade was high on the agenda.
The world's top economies declaring their support for free trade. Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says it's a positive sign.
The world wants to get on with cooperating. Australia has an interest in trade. We're a trading nation, so there's nothing unusual about supporting free and fair trade.
And there was nothing unusual about the World Trade Organization's aims when it began in 1995. To ensure international trade flowed smoothly, predictably, and freely. Its rules have underpinned globalisation as we've come to know it. Today on Rear Vision, we're checking in on the state of the WTO. We'll trace the story of the organisation from its origins as the GATT and ask whether it can still play a meaningful role in managing the trade realities of the 21st century. To get the full story, we need to go back in time, to the docks of 19th century Europe. As the industrial age took off, world trade went gangbusters. That's if you are a colonial power.
The late 19th century was the first great era of globalization. There was a great deal of trade, and a lot of that had to do with technological innovations, like much larger ships and telecommunications. I'm Steve Sylvia. I'm a professor of international relations at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C. Once we entered the 20th century, there were several things that happened that led to a cutting back on trade. Obviously, if you have world wars, it's very difficult to trade. In the 20th century, there were 3 big events that led to a setback as far as trade. The first was the First World War, which was from 1914 to 1918. And then the next one was the Great Depression, which began in 1929 and lasted well into the 1930s. And that was a huge hit to world trade. And the final one was, of course, the Second World War, which ran from 1939 to 1945. Trade, or the inability to trade, was one of the principal claims that both Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany had for going to war. The Germans under Adolf Hitler talked about Lebensraum, living space, that Germany was too constrained, and that one of the objectives of the war was to go east, particularly toward the Soviet Union, to build a greater landmass to support the German economy. So trade was a big issue. The other thing that the Germans and the Japanese had complaints about was European colonialism, which shut off and favored the colonies of the various European countries. The Japanese said that they were constrained, and they talked about creating an East Asian co-prosperity sphere that they said would help everyone in East Asia, but it really was a straight-up colonial endeavor on the part of the Japanese.
Japan was worried about where it was going to source natural resources and thought it might be blocked by Western powers, And so that's why they began to sweep into Southeast Asia for oil reserves and things of that sort.
Douglas Irwin is Professor of Economics at Dartmouth College, New Hampshire.
By 1945, the world economy was really in shambles, and the mantle of international economic leadership had really passed from Britain to the United States. And the U.S. in particular felt discriminated against. There were imperial preferences. Britain in the early 1930s gave tariff preferences to Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and other former colonies. So we wanted sort of a level playing field in the sense that the tariff should be non-discriminatory and the same for all countries.
Colonial powers in those days controlled most of Africa and a big piece of Asia. So as a result, when we are in the Second World War and when it looks increasingly like the Allies are going to win the war, the United States, under Franklin Roosevelt and then eventually Harry Truman as president, planned a creation of something that never existed before. And that is a set of international organizations to manage the world economy.
The US took the lead and in 1944 established the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund.
One of the reasons why the US was so interested in expanding world trade after World War II is the idea that if you have a prosperous, flourishing world economy, it dissipates the need for territorial acquisition and war. And integration acts as a force against international conflict by bringing countries and people together.
The United States also took the lead in trying to create a third organization to handle trade. The idea of setting up an international trade organization was a product of the Roosevelt administration, and they were interested in avoiding a third world war above all. So the United States made a very liberal argument that we can obtain world peace through world trade. So the president implemented the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. This was under Harry Truman. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade dealt with tariffs and quotas for the trade of goods. The United States wanted to shore up the European economy in the face of challenges from the Soviet Union.
Churchill warned that an Iron Curtain had descended across the continent. And this was really designed to free international trade and have private enterprise take the leadership in global commerce. Obviously, the US and the UK were the two main participants, but included a smattering of Western European countries, some Latin American countries as well. It was only 23, so it wasn't global in scope, but they were sort of scattered around the world. And I think Australia and New Zealand were also participants at that first round.
The initial group in 1947 comprised 23 nations, the majority being the wealthiest economies. Countries such as Chile, Burma, and southern Rhodesia were the exception.
So back in 1947, when the GATT was implemented, and they began to hash out rules for this organization, one of them was the most favored nation principle. Every single country had to sign a most favored nation agreement with every single other member of the GATT. What it means is that any country who signs on to a most favored nation principle will give to other countries that have signed a most favored nation agreement the lowest tariff that it has with any other country. So if the United States negotiated a reduction in the tariff on bicycles from 15% to 10%, any country that had a most favored nation agreement with the United States would also get that reduction without having to go through a new round of talks with the United States. So this was a way to even the playing field.
I'm Jane Kelsey. I'm an emeritus professor of law at the University of Auckland in Aotearoa, New Zealand. The notion of most favored nation treatment, which is that the best treatment you give to one country, you should give to all of the rest, was seen as a fundamental gain, especially for developing countries, because it would enable the cherry picking and favoritism that big players might show to each other or to specific countries to be at least reduced. But at the same time, there was a recognition that the more poorer countries that joined, there needed to be some space for catch-up.
By 1965, the GATT had more than doubled in number and now included many new countries who'd gained their independence in the wave of post-war decolonization.
So there was a whole new set of countries that were independent, and the United States and Western Europe and Australia were looking to integrate these countries into the Western economic order rather than have them be tempted to join in with the Soviet Union.
Countries such as India, Nigeria, Ghana, and Malaysia were being welcomed into the GATT, but the trade rules didn't seem to work quite as well for them.
So these countries had a lot of complaints. They said, well, this GATT agreement, it's something that was written by and for the colonial powers. And so the complaint was that the decision-making process for these trade rounds focused on the countries that were the major importers or exporters of products. Well, only the largest economies are the major importers or exporters of most products, countries like the United States or Germany or Japan. So the leaders of the newly independent countries said, this means we aren't involved in the preliminary talks or even the final talks for setting the tariffs. Another big problem with the GATT is it was toothless. Any member of the GATT could object to a penalty that was found against a country if it was found to have violated the trade rules. Even the country that was found guilty of violating the GATT rules could object, and then there would be no penalty. So as a result, there were never any penalties. And, you know, the biggest offender was the United States. Whenever anything upset domestic interests, the United States would be quick to carve out exceptions. In the 1950s, the United States carved out an exception for agriculture. It did one for trade in textiles and apparel, expanded it in the 1960s, and expanded it again in the 1970s.
And developing countries said that the GATT wasn't fair to them. And if they were going to be involved more deeply in global trade rules, there needed to be a fairer system.
The international trading system was flourishing during the 1970s and 80s, but often at the expense of the poorer countries. Agriculture wasn't included, and the US was now asking for technology and services to be added. The developing countries wanted significant changes.
The US said, oh, you want changes? Well, these are the things we want as the price for it. The US said, we've got a whole new range of areas of importance to us, intellectual property rights, services, investment. Developing countries said, yes, but hold on, the rules that you had before gave you all sorts of special treatment. It left textiles out, left agriculture out. Those are our areas. So if we're going to have a new round of negotiations, we want to renegotiate those rules.
In the 1980s, the GATT almost ground to a halt. Less and less of world trade was happening under GATT rules. Free trade areas began to be created. The European Economic Community, which eventually became the European Union, the North American Free Trade Agreement, Mercosur in South America, ASEAN in East Asia. It meant as more and more of these organizations were created, less and less of world trade was happening under GATT rules.
And big changes were on the way. You're with Radio National. And today on Rear Vision, we're looking at international trade and the start of the World Trade Organization. I'm Ros Bluett. By the mid-1980s, the world had outgrown the 1947 GATT agreement. There were now 102 countries, all who wanted to be part of a trade club, but not this one. So in 1986, in Uruguay, global talks created momentum for something new and better.
The countries got together. They began talks in 1986, and it took until 1990s to come to an agreement, which was the document that created the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization extended the coverage of the GATT beyond just covering goods to cover services and intellectual property. The high-income countries agreed to phase out any restrictions on the textile and apparel trade within 10 years, so by 2005.
The Uruguay round that led to the World Trade Organization, the agenda there was a lot of trade-offs. There had to be agreement, and nothing was agreed until everything was agreed. The GATT was genuinely about trade and commodities. What happened with the World Trade Organization was that the agenda expanded massively. The new items that the US wanted put on the agenda reflected the shift that was happening with the emergence, for example, of the Asian tiger economies that were industrializing. The US's advantages were much more in intellectual property and technology and finance and services. And so they wanted rules that would benefit their transnational companies.
In 1995, the GATT was officially replaced by the World Trade Organization. Total membership had now reached 128 countries. And the benefits of being part of the WTO weren't only in the easing of tariff barriers. The World Trade Organization covered rules regarding quarantine, sanitary and phytosanitary measures, testing standards and food labelling.
So the Uruguay round marks this transition from the GATT to the WTO. And I'd say, to sort of summarize it, included many more countries than had previously been included in the GATT. It included many more strict rules and also included a dispute settlement mechanism to adjudicate, considered the crown jewel of the WTO system or the world trading system.
The World Trade Organization dispute settlement mechanism worked. It permitted countries to enact penalty tariffs against a respondent country if it were found to have violated the agreement. And this is in contrast to organizations like the World Court or the International Criminal Court, which can issue statements and ask countries to do anything, but they can't enforce them. The dispute settlement mechanism had an enforcement process that worked.
And despite applying, China was still among the countries yet to be admitted.
But when the WTO and the Uruguay round was concluded, China was not a part of it. And China wanted to join in the late 1990s. So they had to negotiate with the US, the EU, and other members. In some sense, that worked out and didn't work out. It worked out in the sense that China made a lot of changes to its own trade policy, opened up its economy, and has generally adhered to the rules. The downside is that many of the rules didn't really fit China. Subsidies, which are not transparent in China, are not explicit, are hidden through the banking system and cheap credit and what have you. And that's not really covered by the WTO. And that's sort of a big part of what China's done over the past few years. So in that sense, it was sort of I wouldn't say a failure of the WTO, but it's just incomplete in terms of dealing with a country that's very different in terms of its rules. China adheres to the rules of the WTO, but has a lot of policies that are not covered by the rules, such as subsidies through the credit system and what have you. That system began to break down and is in shambles now at the moment.
And we'll get back to the current shambles in a moment. But on the World Trade Organization timeline, it's 1999. The next summit is planned for Seattle to discuss, among other things, the admitting of China and over a dozen other countries.
We also need to locate this in the 90s, which was the time of neoliberalism. The World Trade Organization shifted the spectrum completely to what subsequently has been referred to as a hyper-globalization model that excluded a whole range of other non-market considerations. We've seen instability right from the Battle of Seattle in 1999.
Good evening, I'm Mark Colvin. Welcome to PM. First tonight to the battle on the streets of Seattle, where forces against globalization and big business have been pitting themselves against police and the National Guard.
This is your final warning. Please move to the north.
Summit of the World Trade Organization for them has become a symbol of everything wrong with international capital's drive to transcend national boundaries and regulations, and in the process drawn attention to their belief that the WTO is hostile to workers' rights.
Seattle's mayor and the state governor had declared the state of emergency after thousands of protesters prevented the opening of the World Trade Organization talks yesterday.
The criticism from the political left, the anti-globalization movement, has been that this post-war trade regime has favored commerce over everything else. The World Trade Organization will not intervene to decide how you should make your products. That if someone produces a bicycle, how that bicycle came into existence is not something that countries can use to discriminate when it comes to trade.
Seattle was an important moment because, one, it happened in the US. Two, it was the first attempt to expand the World Trade Organization. And the message that was given was that the idea of a constitution for global capitalism was not an acceptable form of a global constitution. Whilst there was a lot of focus on the turtles and the dolphins and the environment issues and so on, I think we have to take a cumulative look at this extreme version of neoliberalism, this hyper-globalization model, really created its own internal implosions. And we're seeing the consequences of that now, but we're seeing the advocates of that, including some of our countries, New Zealand and Australia, who want to pretend that that's not a problem. That hyper-globalization model that it adopted has generated a really significant backlash in many places. It's not just what's happened with the MAGA movement. We had Brexit. We've had a whole lot of resistances in lots of countries, including the Indian farmers and so on. And so we need to rethink what it is about the model itself that has had really adverse economic, social, political consequences. But overlay on that the challenges of things like the climate crisis and COVID pandemics and what happens when private players and big tech run all the data and the systems of supply chains and so on. Those are big questions. They are nowhere near the agenda of the WTO at present.
And throw into the mix the rapid pace of globalization and geopolitical skirmishes playing into the WTO. And now with 166 member countries, the organisation can be unwieldy to control. Added to this, the United States' refusal from 2019 to appoint a judge to the dispute settlement panel, rendering it powerless. Little wonder regional and bilateral relationships are mushrooming.
It's hard to use the World Trade Organization to make any progress if the United States is recalcitrant, because the World Trade Organization relies on consensus. And if the member with the biggest economy is the biggest dissenter, it's very hard to make progress. So this is what has led many countries during this first year of the second Trump administration to begin to strengthen the regional trade agreements that they have developed over the decades.
As long as the US and China are sort of at loggerheads and are not getting along very well, it's going to be very difficult for the institution to move forward in a very constructive way. In fact, even if they did get along, it might be difficult to move things forward precisely for the reasons that I said of getting a consensus of 23 countries is hard enough. That was the original GATT. but getting 163 countries together, much more difficult. So that's why I do think that countries will choose the path of least resistance, which is get like-minded countries who have a similar interest in liberalizing trade to write new rules. And that's what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is. That's what a lot of the bilateral agreements that the European Union has reached. Well, what's interesting is that even though the WTO has encountered these difficulties, countries are still members. So there still seems to be some value and benefit having that basic set of rules as sort of a benchmark for how we conduct trade across countries. But once again, countries increasingly feel free to break those rules for strategic reasons, political reasons, and what have you. And that's why the system is a little bit shakier than it had been.
Stephen Sylvia feels the system is currently at its shakiest.
It will be very hard for the World Trade Organization to regain relevance in the wake of what President Trump has done. President Trump has completely gone against many of the core principles of the WTO regime. President Trump has completely ignored the most favored nation principle. The United States has walked away from the dispute settlement system. It's an irony that this post-World War II trade regime that the United States was instrumental in creating, and for which you can make a strong case, has contributed greatly to the affluence of the post-war era, that it is the United States that is dismantling it.
Not every country is just blowing up the rule book the way the U.S. has. 85% of world trade still continues under WTO rules, and it's still very useful. So the countries still value the free flow of trade across countries and get a benefit from that. We're all on this planet together. There's interdependence, and we just need to manage that well. And you can't do that by setting your own course by yourself.
So what would it take to revive the WTO?
When one asks the question, what would it take to revive the World Trade Organization? It would take a fundamental change in the politics of the United States. There would have to be a neo-Roosevelt era, a neo-Truman era that embraces these old liberal values and that embraces this idea that world peace is secured through world trade. We are in the United States nowhere near a Roosevelt revival, but that's what it would take.
I'm not at all surprised about the chaos, and it's not just Trump. Trump has thrown a grenade into the process, but it was already quite dysfunctional. So those whose solution is to try to put Humpty back together again, excuse all the mixed metaphors, aren't asking the fundamental question of why is it broken? The chaos in the entire international trading system, whether it's in the WTO, the bilateral deals that Trump is doing, the demands for priority access to critical minerals and not entering into deals with other countries, all of this is a part of a script that we have yet to see unfold. Who knows in terms of international trading relationships what will happen in that next decade?
Jane Kelsey, Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Auckland in Aotearoa, New Zealand, ending today's program. You also heard from Douglas Irwin, Professor of Economics at Dartmouth College in the US, and Stephen Sylvia, Professor of International Relations at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C. Today's sound engineer was Tim Jenkins. I'm Ros Bluett. You've been listening to Rear Vision on Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.